And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. I'm Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, www.freakradio.org. And I want to tell you, it's 1st of September. Time's moving on. You probably should have a pencil and paper handy just in case you want to write down some names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, social security numbers, whatever it takes to get the job done. Because you're the activist. I'm just telling you about what's happening. Let's start with announcements. The Grand Canyon Tramway legislation has been introduced, and comments are needed in the next few days. Late on the day on Monday, August 29th, the legislation was introduced into the Navajo Nation Tribal Council to build a tramway in the Grand Canyon. Under Navajo Nation law, the public the world over now has just 5 days to comment on the legislation. Sponsored by Fort Defiance Councilman Ben Bennett, the legislation gives the green light to a massive development on the rim of the Grand Canyon. The project would include a huge resort, an airport, helicopter tours, and a tramway to the canyon bottom at the confluence of the Little Colorado and the main Colorado rivers. The project anticipates between 800,000 to 2 million annual visitors per year at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. A group of Phoenix developers known as Confluence Partners LLC would receive from 92% to 88% of the revenues generated. And the LLC has no prior company experience with any type of construction. The Navajo Nation legislation spells out the duties of the partners and requires the Navajo Nation to expend at a minimum $65 million for a 20-mile all-weather road to the development location, as well as to provide power, water, and telecommunications. A loan from the Navajo Nation to cover these costs would be repaid out of any royalties received. Legislation passed in 1975 by Congress recognized that the entire Grand Canyon has many managers, including the National Park Service, the Navajo Nation, and other tribes and agencies. The law requires the Secretary of Interior to work with all the Grand Canyon's many managers in providing protection and interpretation of the Grand Canyon in its entirety. Legislation known as the Grand Canyon Enlargement Act required the Secretary of Interior to work with the Navajo Nation to protect the Grand Canyon, designated a World Heritage Site. River Runners for Wilderness encourages its members to write to the Navajo Nation and the Secretary of Interior, Sally Jewell, and tell them that you support a tramway-free Grand Canyon, and ask that Navajo tribal funds be spent on vital needs such as housing, sanitation, telecommunication, and water supply projects across the entire western Navajo lands. Remind the Navajo Nation and Secretary Jewell of her duty to work with the Navajo to protect and preserve the Grand Canyon as the 1975 Grand Canyon Enlargement Act requires. And here's how you can contact the Navajo Nation. Write to comments at navajo-nsn.gov. Once again, that's comments at navajo-nsn.gov. I do have a mail address here, but given the time is sort of running out, you got till Friday, I don't think a letter's going to get there. Navajo Nation law requires that all comments, either in the form of letters or emails, must include your name, position, title, address for written comments, and a valid email address. Anonymous comments will not be included or considered. If you need further information, contact Tom Martin at River Runners for Wilderness. That's Tom Martin, all one word, T-O-M-M-A-R-T-I-N, at rrfw.org. Once again, that's Tom Martin, all one word, at rrr.fw.org. And you can find additional information on the web at www.savetheconfluence.com. That's savetheconfluence.com. And in Canada, we get word that hundreds of mink have been freed in this story from Biteback, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Here's an anonymous communique they received. A letter to the public. Last evening, we took a road trip to Litchi Mink Fur Farm, 5531 Shummer Lane, Linwood, Ontario, where thousands of animals are needlessly killed every year for the stupidity of fashion. We cut holes in the fence and opened the cages to hundreds of mink, setting them free into the night. We are proud that we can make a difference in the lives of these animals. Confining and killing living beings for clothing is an abomination and atrocity when we can easily make clothes from synthetic materials without any bloodshed. Litchi Fur Farm is indistinguishable from a puppy mill. The space each mink has is barely enough to turn around, and these animals are treated no better than disposable trash. These death factories that pass themselves off as farms fly in the face of what is decent and just. Any law that allows for animals to be tortured and abused has no place and no right to be respected by responsible people. This liberation is dedicated to Anita Kranchik from Ontario, a pig saver who stands on trial today for simply giving water to thirsty pigs on slaughter trucks. This is a mockery of justice and an absurdity of reason that a law could criminalize an act of kindness. Signed, Mothers Against Fur Farm Cruelty. And if you need more information, go to www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. We also read that story, Did Japan Just Win the Whale Wars? By David Kirby of Take Part, as found in the Earth First Newswire. The whale wars are over, or are they? Each year, the International Sea Shepherd Movement dispatches vessels to harass Japanese ships hunting whales in the Southern Ocean. Using acid-filled bottles, smoke bombs, lasers, and metal-reinforced rope to damage propellers and rudders, Sea Shepherd activists aim to stop the slaughter conducted by Japan's Institute of Cetacean Research in violation of international whaling regulations. But last week, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, that's the one in the United States, the International Coalition's U.S. branch, and its founder, Paul Watson, settled a 5-year legal battle in federal court with the ICR and Kyoto Senpaku Kaisha, the company that furnishes whaling vessels and crews. Sea Shepherd USA agreed to a permanent injunction that bars the group from attacking or endangering whaling vessels or approaching any whalers closer than 1,500 feet. The settlement also prohibits Sea Shepherd USA from providing money or property to anyone, including other Sea Shepherd entities, to support the confrontations. Sea Shepherd USA has a long history of battling Japanese whalers in court and in the icy Southern Ocean. From 2005 until 2012, Watson and his group sent ships to take part in the dangerous high seas dramas that captivated audiences in the Animal Planet reality series Whale Wars, and according to the Sea Shepherd, saved the lives of 3,651 whales. A temporary injunction against the U.S. group was first imposed by a U.S. federal judge in 2012. In 2015, Sea Shepherd agreed to pay the whalers $2.6 million for violating that injunction. As part of the settlement, Sea Shepherd will receive compensation from the whaling operators for a 2010 incident in which a Sea Shepherd-affiliated powerboat, the 80 Gill, was rammed and sunk by a Japanese whaling vessel. But Sea Shepherd contends that there is nothing in the permanent injunction to prevent other Sea Shepherd groups from continuing the harassment as long as they are not acting in concert with the U.S. group. We are independent and separate entities, and the people in Australia and Europe are quite offended that the U.S. would presume to have any jurisdiction over that, Watson said. These are Dutch-registered ships owned by a European entity in Australian waters going after Japanese fishermen. What possible jurisdiction could the U.S. have? It only covers the Sea Shepherd USA's involvement. The U.S. group's general counsel, Peter Risman, concurred with that interpretation. We will not operate a campaign in the Southern Ocean, nor will we cooperate or encourage or facilitate in any campaign by other Sea Shepherd entities, Risman said. If we were to act in concert of them, we would be found in contempt of the injunction. That's why we won't. But a U.S.-based spokesman for the Institute of Cetacean Research, Gavin Carter, suggested that any Sea Shepherd group might still be in legal jeopardy if it harasses the whalers. It puts the ICR in a strong legal position, and it has achieved the objective to ensure safety at sea, not just for Japanese vessels and crew, but also the crews on other vessels, Carter said. I think that if Sea Shepherd and its affiliates do break their injunction, he added, they are taking a substantial risk that could lead to significant penalties, which would depend on the circumstances. Jeff Hansen, managing director of Sea Shepherd Australia, vowed to take on the whalers when they head off this December to kill up to 330 minke whales. We are not concerned about the U.S. court settlement as it does not have any effect on Australian law, Hansen said in a statement. On Tuesday, Sea Shepherd Global announced it had added a new high-speed patrol vessel to its fleet, the Ocean Warrior, which it says will be able to outrun Japanese whaling ships for the first time. Speed can be a deciding factor when saving the lives of whales, Alex Cornelissen, the group's chief executive, said in a statement. Last November, the Federal Court of Australia fined Kyoto Senpaku Kaisha $711,000 for violating a 2008 injunction against whaling in the Australian Antarctic Whale Sanctuary. It was yet another blow to Japan's continued effort to hunt whales. And the real culprits of the mule deer decline in Colorado are not cougars and bears in this article by George Werthner, as found in Counterpunch on the Earth First Newswire. Colorado Parks and Wildlife is proposing a study whereby they will kill mountain lions, cougars, pumas, or whatever you want to call them, and bears in the northwest portion of the state to see if it can help boost mule deer populations. It must be noted that mule deer have been on the decline around the West for decades, and no one has really been able to pinpoint the reasons. Colorado's highest population estimate occurred in 1983, when mule deer numbers reached an estimated 625,000, yet today the population is under 400,000. In the case of northwest Colorado, some suggest that ongoing oil and gas development could be the cause of the recent deer decline. In 1989, there were 5,000 oil and gas wells in the state. By 2014, the number had risen to 32,000. Each of these wells requires a pad, access roads, power lines, pipelines, and other industrial support. All of this fragmenting of mule deer habitat, blocking migration corridors, as well as creating human activity in what were formerly remote lands. Research in other states like Wyoming have concluded that energy development does indeed harm mule deer. Add in livestock grazing on public lands, especially in drought years when cattle and sheep can graze all forbs, grasses, and many shrubs to the ground, and you have additional stress on mule deer. Other factors affecting the sagebrush sea where mule deer reside, such as the record drought, which can reduce the nutritional quality of the forage, as well as the spread of cheatgrass facilitated both by livestock grazing and ongoing energy development. Cheatgrass can increase the fire frequency in sagebrush areas, leading to excessive losses of sagebrush and important winter food for deer. Past high mule deer numbers, encouraged by state wildlife agencies, may also be a factor in today's decline. The heyday for mule deer meant some important forage species were heavily grazed and browsed to the point where the habitat's ability to support mule deer has declined. In some cases, it has not recovered, especially when drought conditions preclude good vegetation growth. Finally, to add insult to injury, some parts of Colorado rural housing tracts are gobbling up winter range and increasing human activity in critical mule deer habitat. All of these combined means you have a perfect storm for mule deer decline. Indeed, one would have to wonder why mule deer haven't declined more, given these factors. Yet predators are being targeted as the culprit. The scapegoating of predators has gone on for more than 100 years, and what study after study has already previously concluded is that predators are seldom the ultimate factor in ungulate declines. For instance, if habitat quality declines, say, from drought, then mule deer fawn may be born underweight or have less security or simply are displaced from traditional winter range and are therefore more vulnerable to predators. But ultimately, it is drought, cheatgrass, cows, or energy development which are the ultimate factors that create predator vulnerability. Predators may be the proximate cause of ungulate decline in some places for a short time, but keep in mind that predators are ultimately determined by the availability of prey. If mule deer decline and there are few alternatives, predator numbers will fall in line with their food resources. Some wonder why a state wildlife agency such as Colorado Parks and Wildlife is targeting predators when all these other factors are involved. The obvious answer is that they are afraid to attack the energy, livestock, and housing industries and their political supporters like rural county commissioners. But why is a decline in mule deer even an issue? Mule deer in Colorado are by no means endangered. There are hundreds of thousands of them. The issue is that the numbers have fallen below objectives. Objectives is a code word for desired production. The Colorado Parks and Wildlife has set a target for mule deer it believes can be sustained and still hunted. If the population falls too low, the department will have no choice but to cut hunting seasons shorter or make other adjustments that will be unpopular with hunters. The problem is that all state wildlife agencies depend on the sale of hunting tags and licenses to fund their bureaucracies. Thus, these agencies are not going to bite the hand that feeds them. even if there is the perception that predators are responsible for mule deer declines, the Colorado Parks and Wildlife will develop its management strategy in part based upon these perceptions. If Colorado Parks and Wildlife sincerely cared about the future of mule deer, not just the future of its bureaucracy, it would be far more aggressive in going after the factors that are causing the long-term decline in mule deer habit quality. These factors are energy development, livestock grazing, and rural housing sprawl. As a state agency fearful of attacking and antagonizing any major industries, the Colorado Parks and Wildlife picks up the one thing that does not have a major lobby and political influence: predators. Sadly, this is the same situation throughout the country. In the end, this strategy is going to lead to the demise of the state wildlife agencies themselves, because even if you remove predators temporarily from the picture, the habitat quality is going to decline, and so will deer numbers. If these agencies are interested in preserving mule deer, much less even their weak-kneed bureaucracies, they would be outspoken in their condemnation of the industries that are the real reasons for mule deer declines everywhere. And about the author, George Werthner has published 36 books, including Wildfire, A Century of Failed Forest Policy, and he serves on the board of the Western Watersheds Project. And we thank the Earth First Newswire at www.earthfirstjournal.org/newswire for that commentary. And now let's turn to biodiversity news. West Coast whale entanglements are increasing and may break a record this year. Nearly 40 reports of whales entangled in fishing gear have been recorded off the West Coast in 2016. In 2015, there were 61 reported entanglements, up from 30 in 2014. Before that, the average was around 8 entanglements a year. Some whales do end up escaping from fishing gear, often with the help of whale rescue teams that are now being overwhelmed, but those that don't escape often die slow, painful deaths. In response to the latest figures, the Center for Biological Diversity is calling on Dungeness crab fishermen to remove more fishing lines from Monterey Bay and other areas where whales, including endangered humpbacks and blues, are now feeding and being seen entangled. The center has also urged regulators to take swift action to address the problem. This has become a crisis. We recognize that crabbers don't want to harm whales. Now they need to act to avoid important biological areas where whales feed, said Kristen Monsell, a center attorney. And that story is a little dated. We can't always get to these when they're first released. Crab season has been over for a couple of months, and we'll start up again in a couple of months with the same problems. And a petition aims to protect tricolored bats from disease and habitat loss. Tricolored bats have declined dramatically over the past 10 years due to a deadly fungal disease called white nose syndrome. Range-wide, they've lost a third of their population, and in the Northeast, the disease has killed 98% of tricolored bats in some areas. These small insect-eating bats with fluttery flight patterns and fur of three colors are also at risk from cave disturbances, habitat loss, and wind energy development, and they need help soon. That's why the Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to protect them under the Endangered Species Act. Tricolored bats are in grave trouble, and it's time the feds took action to keep them from tumbling off the cliff of extinction, said the center's Molly Madison. Among the three bats most devastated by white nose syndrome, the tricolored has been virtually forgotten, but that can't continue if it's to survive this disease. And a lawsuit has been launched over protections denied to Pacific fishers. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have filed a notice of intent to sue over the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision in April to deny Endangered Species Act protection to Pacific fishers, the latest species to fall victim to the service's efforts to cater to industry. Closely related to martens and wolverines, fishers are severely threatened by habitat loss caused by logging and the use of toxic rodenticides on illegal marijuana-growing sites. Although the service had previously proposed federal protection for Pacific fishers, which have dwindled to just two populations in Oregon and California, the agency reversed course at the last minute to bow to the timber industry. Fishers are staring extinction in the face, so it's deeply disheartening to see the service deny them the protection they need to survive, said the center's Justin Augustine. Science, not politics, should drive these kinds of decisions, and that didn't happen here. And this week we received word from the Center for Biological Diversity that the Fish and Wildlife Service has agreed to reconsider fishers. And a death toll of 3.2 million animals were killed by wildlife services in 2015. The newest tallies from America's secretive wildlife killing program are in, and they're grim. U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services says it killed more than 3.2 million animals during fiscal year 2015. That's about 500,000 more animals than the program killed the previous year. Despite increasing calls for reform, Wildlife Services' reckless slaughter continues, last year wiping out 385 gray wolves, 68,905 coyotes, 480 black bears, 284 mountain lions, 731 bobcats, 492 river otters, 3,437 foxes, and 21,559 beavers. The center has been leading the charge to reform this rogue program, which often does its killing at the behest of the agricultural industry and its powerful interests. There's simply no scientific basis for continuing to shoot poison and strangle millions of animals every year. It's a cruel practice that not only fails to effectively manage targeted wildlife, but poses an ongoing threat to other animals, including pets, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Michael Robinson. And a rare California salamander has won a recovery plan thanks to a suit by the Center for Biological Diversity. Rare, beautiful California tiger salamanders in Sonoma County won a final recovery plan to aid their survival and eventual recovery and removal from the endangered species list. The plan calls to purchase and permanently protect about 15,000 acres of the salamanders' breeding ponds and adjacent uplands. Although Sonoma County's tiger salamanders have been protected as endangered for more than a decade, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service hadn't developed a recovery plan to guide management of the species, so in 2012 the center sued, and the lawsuit settlement resulted in the victory. The plan focuses on fighting major threats such as habitat loss and fragmentation by protecting breeding ponds and adjacent uplands. It also calls for reducing risks from non-native predators, roads, contaminants, and disease. This plan gives us hope for one of our most imperiled salamanders, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Jenny Loda. And the U.S. pet trade annually imports 6 million fish exposed to cyanide. A new analysis by the Center for Biological Diversity and For the Fishes finds that 6 million tropical marine fish imported into the United States each year for the pet trade have been exposed to cyanide poisoning. The findings coincide with the release of Disney Pixar's movie Finding Dory, which is likely to fuel a rapid increase in the sale of tropical reef fish in the United States, including royal blue tangs like Dory. To catch fish with cyanide, crushed cyanide tablets are placed in squirt bottles filled with seawater. The dissolved cyanide is then sprayed directly onto reefs near the targeted fish to stun them and make it easier to scoop them up. Sadly, as many as 50% of all nearby fish are killed on contact, as well as the nearby corals. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies have called upon the Obama administration to ban aquarium fish caught using cyanide. And trade sanctions have been sought against Mexico to save the vanishing porpoises. Vaquitas, small porpoises that live only in the Gulf of California, are the world's most endangered marine mammals, with fewer than 60 left on Earth. To stop vaquitas from vanishing completely, the Center for Biological Diversity urged the Obama administration to take a serious step, impose trade sanctions on Mexico to halt its illegal trade in totoaba and endangered fish. Nets for the country's totoaba fishery are the biggest threats to vaquita survival. The latest center action follows a series of steps we've taken both in the United States and in Mexico to save both vaquitas and totoaba from extinction. No measures taken by Mexico so far have stopped either the trade in endangered fish or the decline of the tiny porpoise. The facts are simple. Mexico's failure to stop the ongoing totoaba trade violates its treaty obligations and is killing off the vaquita, said Sarah Ulleman, our international program director. The totoaba and vaquita have waited too long for effective action. It's time to ban seafood imports until Mexico stops its destructive totoaba trade. And has another wolf made it to California? There's news about the possibility of a new wolf in California. State Wildlife Department has released new evidence, not yet conclusive, that there may be a wolf in Lassen County. The information includes photos from four trail cameras between August and May of this year and a hair sample from one of the sites. The fact the animal persisted through the winter in this remote location leads agency officials to believe the animal is likely a wolf. In late 2011, a wolf called OR7 was the first of his kind to enter the Golden State in nearly a century, a radio-collared wolf that dispersed to California from the Imnahapakan northeastern part of the state of Oregon. He has since found a mate and had litters of pups in three consecutive years. Another wolf family, dubbed the Shasta Pact, was confirmed last year in California's Siskiyou County. We've crossed our fingers that yet another wolf has arrived in the state as part of the ongoing recovery of wolves across the West, said the Center for Biological Diversity's Amarok Weiss. Wolves continue to prove what scientists have said all along, that California is a great habitat for them. And a rare Puerto Rican bird gets federal protection plus 27,000 acres. Thanks to a landmark settlement with the Center for Biological Diversity, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has given Puerto Rico's Elfin Woods Warbler Endangered Species Act protection and proposed habitat protection across more than 27,000 acres. Most of the warbler's habitat has been lost to urban and agricultural development. The Elfin Woods Warbler is a 5-inch bird that was first discovered in the dwarf forest of El Yunque National Forest in the 1970s. In 2004, the center petitioned to protect it under the act, but it took our historic 757 species settlement in 2011 to bring protection for the animal. With the help of the Endangered Species Act, the Elfin Woods Warbler will recover like other Puerto Rican birds before it, said the center's Jacqueline Lopez. The act has an excellent track record of increasing or stabilizing populations of birds like the Puerto Rican parrot, yellow-shouldered blackbird, or Puerto Rican plain pigeon. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. for a rebroadcast here on Free Radio. In North Adams, Massachusetts, tune in to WMNB 107.1 on Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. In Moscow, Idaho, tune in to KRFP 90.3 FM Wednesdays at 3 p.m. In Dade City, Florida, tune in to WLSL 92.7 Sundays at noon. You can go online to the Grateful Dread Public Radio at gdprnashville.org Sundays at 2 a.m. You can also find them on TuneIn and Spotify. Or you could go to radioforall.net where you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First Update broadcasts. That's radio, the number, for all.net. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to ask you to ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download from radioforall.net and air. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. It's produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.